things are getting more complex. Organizations like IBM are working on things that are called big data and big analytics. Some of that's kind of a nasty term with the federal government and some of the things they're doing, but the collection and analyzation of large amounts of data is becoming a very trendy thing across all kinds of aspects, from the academic world out to the enterprise world. Fast pace, things need to go really quickly. You guys are well aware of that. Standing up applications, moving applications, getting things time to market, tested, debugged, and up and running, those time frames have shrunk significantly over a period of time. And then just the numbers of devices. When we look at smartphones, when we look at laptops, when we look at on the street corners and the cafes, you've got access to data. It's really an environment that's anytime, anywhere. It's really moved from, I call it a utility. You know, it started out with, you know, you plugged in and you got something on the network, to you really relying on it, maybe more so than the dial tone, than the telephone, that you try and get access to data. A number of aspects that are also impacting it are social media. I mean, we look at the number of companies. I know Twitter announced that they were going IPO. They were going to schedule their IPO sometime here shortly. Again, that social touch to a number of different customers and clients out there is really causing enterprise organizations to rethink their data infrastructure, to rethink their application environment. And I'll share some things with you as we go through the presentation, but it's really breaking down a bunch of barriers that were siloed, specific applications, specific amounts of dollars were associated with certain applications, that the social applications are starting to take a lot of priority. And actually the chief marketing officers in many companies are becoming very active in technology spend within organizations. The challenges to this are not insignificant from a network standpoint. When we look at the network today, it's really an evolution of a lot of protocols. We say IP is kind of the defining protocol for much of what we do, but there are so many control protocols to make things work that you really start to have people that have had a length of experience in networking almost have a PhD in protocols out there to get things to work. It's very complex. It's very dependent. It's very vendor-centric that takes place. And it's very hard to scale. It's very hard to come to an organization today and say your network is X number of ports. Let's double the number of data centers and double the number of ports, and let's do it this year. I mean, you'd have the network people kind of fall over at that point in time. They can't get there. And in many cases, many changes in the network are done in, at best, monthly intervals. That 12 p.m. on a Saturday night is when everybody gathers around to make a command line change on hundreds or thousands of devices. And you kind of cross your fingers with whatever scripts or tools you use that those changes are all done successfully. You press the reboot button, everything comes back up after everything converges, and you hope it works. Software rollouts become very infrequent because of the same challenge. Is it within the quarter? What's the business doing? What's the organization doing? And can I do that software upgrade and get those new features or bug fixes? You know, many customers are telling me today that I want to do it once a year at best. And many of the networking vendors out there are spending 3 to 4 versions a year to come up with a new feature or a bug fix. And it's really putting strain on many different customers. And lastly, it's a switch-by-switch configuration. What version of operating system software you're running, what the command line looks like, is that feature supported? You have to keep kind of a crypt sheet of, I've got this family of devices, it runs this operating system, it can support these features, and you would take piece parts of the network to go make those configurations to make it work. At the same point in time, we're getting all these different applications that are impacting that network, and the network's having to adjust to and support. Mobility users, video. I mean, you look at the smartphone guys, significant portion of their advertising is based on video. And the infrastructure to support that video is not only in LTE, but it's in the back end resources that get you there. And how's that data? The internet obviously is a significant portion of the communication today. And it really creates an unpredictable environment. And that's really kind of the key thing that's driving many of the innovations in software-defined network, that many users or technology infrastructure people will build a network for the worst case. So if they know the bandwidth required to do the Super Bowl, or to do financial closing, or to do registration of students, they build an infrastructure associated with that bandwidth, because they can't have a hiccup. The rest of the time, they don't use the bandwidth. But the next iteration that comes around for a network build, or a network buyout, they build again for that. What's the worst capacity? Let me double it or triple it. And the rest of the time, the network's being used at 20 or 30%. It's very location specific. At the same point in time, where the data resides. There's some tricks to fool that when you use the internet, but it's very, very rigid and very, very siloed is the point that I'm trying to get across. When we look at the data center as it becomes virtualized, virtualization has really taken off, both in the server environment and really more so the storage. And significant cost savings was realized when storage was virtualized, and users were able to basically create multiple tiers of storage. What was really fast, what was kind of maybe 2 years old, and then what was used for backup in their data that wasn't going to be accessed frequently. Then the server got virtualized. And we're still kind of, let's say, halfway there. There's a significant number of people that have not virtualized their infrastructures for various reasons. Some of its complexity, some of its cost, some of its, they'd like to see another vendor, you know, kind of contend in that space. You know, out there, there's one big fish and a bunch of small fish, you know, running around from a market share standpoint. Some people would like to see that settle a little bit. But really, when you look at network virtualization, is none. Or some clients would say that we are doing virtualization, and when you talk about an IP infrastructure and routing and subnetting, you realize that it's not virtualized. It's siloed, and applications sit in those silos. And there's limits to scalability in virtualization. Virtualized networks like to see the same IP address, the same subnet, and they like to see MAC addresses that are on those devices. And those MAC addresses and IP addresses change when you move to different facilities. You know, there, so virtualization tends not to work that well, or it's very, very complex. It requires a lot of manual efforts to make those things work when you're scaling. When we look at the network, it's really statically provisioned. It's that monthly change, weekly, my God, if you were able to do that, maybe less than that. It's a box level, as I talked about, and you really need a PhD in vendor hardware. And there's a lot of people out there that have that, and it's called a CCIE. And those guys are really, really sharp, and they know the products really, really well, but you've got to go to them to make a change to an application environment. And so what we're finding is there's becoming they're not tightly synchronized anymore. The app guys can do something really, really quick, usually hours, and the network guys can take days or weeks to support that. So there's becoming a little bit of a rift there from a time to market standpoint. And it was interesting that one of our friends from Cisco said it takes about 5 days from an end-to-end point of view provision, something like that in a multi-tiered system. And we think that's pretty aggressive. You know, out there. But five, if you were to look at, I've got to get an application up, take school registration or testing at a college, you need 5 days to provision that for a test or for a registration, and the application just came out, you just got it done, and you missed that window. And the application people generally aren't thinking of what does the network need to do out there, and software-defined networks tends to allow us to start to change that. So software-defined networking as a whole is it's time to think outside of the switch. And that's really the premise of one of the premises of software-defined networking as it applies to the network. It's don't think of just the switch anymore. And so you come down and you think, well, what is SDN? And Martin Casado at VMware, who just made a pretty big splash 2 weeks ago in NSX, said, I actually don't know what SDN means anymore, to be honest. Because it means a lot of different things. One of our guys, our chief technology officers, says, what do you want your SDN to be today? Because again, you can kind of mold the message to be anything, you know, out there. What I tend to call it, and what our group tends to call it, is managing complex hardware interactions with software. You've got a lot of switches out there. You've got a lot of security devices out there, and firewalls, intrusion detection, content filtering, load balancing, you know, out there, and you got a bunch of switch ports and router ports that connect all this stuff together. And how do you manage that as a system? One thing that's kind of interesting to understand as I've perused, as I've gone through my territory and talked to many clients, is software-defined networking isn't just network virtualization. But network virtualization is software networking. And he's coined another term that kind of said, if you're a male, you're part of the human race. We went to the bottom of it. But if you're part of the human race, it doesn't mean you're male. So we think of software-defined networking and network virtualization. Network virtualization is the subset. And again, managing hardware, complex hardware interactions with software. So there's a number of market perspectives, you know, out there. And each one of these has a vendor. I actually did something with a channel partner, and we had a big Jeopardy game a couple of weeks ago and put a vendor and put this comment out and had our business partners match it. There's a lot of people out there, when you say software-defined networks, they'll say OpenFlow. Has anybody heard of OpenFlow? Yeah, OpenFlow is a protocol, just like TCP/IP, for all practical purposes. But they think OpenFlow is the underpinnings of software-defined network. And that's really just the transport. That's how the switches and all the devices will talk. It has nothing to do with the application or how you set it up or how you manage it. It's just that protocol. SDN makes the physical network irrelevant. And there's a company out there that has a reference paper that says, it doesn't matter what the network is, we'll take care of it. It can be an existing layer 2-3 network. It could be an open flow network. We will take care of everything out there. There's another vendor out there that says it, you know, has a proprietary vertically integrated SDN their kind of go-to-market is the standards are immature, and they are. I mean, I'm not going to tell you it's all done and baked, but they're immature, and we'll give you an API that you can come down and program our switches. Now, the interesting thing with that, it's still program each switch. It doesn't get you out of how does the application get from end to end. It's you've got to build that interface and every switch and program to it. Another vendor says commodity hardware and custom software. And this is, you know, kind of a true statement, you know, out there from an IBM perspective. We believe that much of the SDN networking hardware will be based on merchant silicon, something that's made by a Broadcom or a Marvell and packaged and sold under a bunch of different labels. And those companies will then put their software on top of that merchant silicon. And what we'll tend to see there is networking electronic stuff gets less expensive. The cost to maintain it will get less expensive over time. And the last one is really IBM's view of it is open, integrated, and innovative. And this is really multiple SDN technologies built into an open platform. And IBM's view of this really is, we've kind of stepped it up a level, and we call it in a number of our marketing papers, and as you hear us talk, a software-defined environment. And the software-defined environment includes software-defined networking, but it also contains applications. It also contains server technology that may or may not be Intel-based. It could be power-based, and I know we're talking about power systems tomorrow. It could be mainframe-based, that the application developer will ultimately select a platform based on the characteristics of the platform. How much processing power, how much memory does it have, what's the display to the end user, and we'll pick those tools. But that environment becomes kind of an umbrella that a number of pieces fit into it. What's kind of accelerating, you know, this process from a networking standpoint is there's these vendors you're well aware of, and one's a sponsor here, HP, Juniper, Cisco, and Brocade, all have kind of today's networking products. And the biggest market share out there is Cisco. Again, all individually programmed, all have all the features that you would buy but may not use in that particular platform and build a network in a traditional fashion. What we're starting to see is there's a lot of vendors coming out. Small startups, again, it's kind of almost a reinvention in my time, and it kind of dates me. The early 80s when Ethernet just started coming out of the labs, and a lot of companies created widgets, created hardware-based products to go and feature the best product at the best price with the best performance, and end users kind of went that direction. We're seeing the same kind of movement from a software standpoint. So a lot of startups getting acquired in various fashions, or a lot of startups with anticipations of going public and being the next, you name it, out there. But we're starting to see that the control point, and I'll show you some slides, the control point of a network infrastructure is moving to software. And it's moving to software outside of the network switch. And that's the big difference, because you could make the argument that there's a ton of software in a switch. And there is. There's 3 to 5 million lines of code in a basic IP routed switch, you know, out there. But you don't need that 3 to 5 million lines of code in every switch. You need a certain subset of features to make that application and make that flow work within the network. So when we look at the shift and what's taking place from a networking perspective, is on the left side is our traditional networking switch. There's a custom ASIC, and a lot of the vendors out there today are heavily invested in custom silicon. The interesting thing about custom silicon is it usually takes a couple years once you've cut your specification to design it, fab it, test it, and bring it to market. And if you make one single mistake, it was actually one of my early companies, and still is, one of the first tests of an ASIC coming off the fab line is, they call it the thermal thumb test. And it's literally a temperature test. Does the ASIC burn too hot from a temperature standpoint? And if so, they gotta go back and redesign it. They lost 2 years, you know, in that market, and they start back at square zero again. So a lot of companies, again, are moving to merchant silicon. They're saying, you take this, you run it to a specification that the whole community generally centers around, and then we'll write software to that hardware and be an abstraction layer. When we look at the other components of the switch, you'll see an operating system, and you'll see a bunch of features. And those features are generally packaged in the words of, you know, enhanced version or extended version or basic version or light version. But you buy all those features. So you have routing, you have multicast, you have monitoring, you may have VPN capability, you have security, you know, out there. But again, in some environments, you may not ever use any of those features in that switch, but you pay for them initially, and you pay for the annual maintenance just in case you do use those. The model is really moving again to a separation of merchant-based silicon, still an operating system, and then a software-defined network interface. And that software-defined network interface communicates up high to a server. And that server today is recommended to be a Linux server. It's an open flow controller. And that open flow controller will contain applications. And those applications will be security, will be routing, will be multicasting or video support. And it will talk to all of the switches via that open flow protocol based on the application requirements. So it really becomes a network that is configured by a number of network administrators that hope, and many times get, all the things that an application will want, to a network where the application defines what it wants, where it wants to go, what kind of performance it wants, what type of security or load balancing it wants. And we'll show you some slides. So again, our overview of this thing, and we're not going to talk all these pictures out there, it is really our software-defined platform is based on network services and applications. We don't think software-defined network works without that. It has a number of orchestration or cloud provisioning platforms. IBM makes some, OpenStack makes some. There's some cloud technologies that are designed to talk to a software-defined network via an API. So that via that API, you can schedule how much bandwidth I want, what type of security I want, who do I want to talk to, when do I want to talk to them. And on the bottom are really, there's two forks in the road today that will ultimately merge. It's how do you get that into the network? How do you work in a software-defined network environment with the network as it exists today? And there's really two ways. Well, there's only one way with the network today, and that's via an overlay product. And that's on the red box that we call it IBM SDN VE. And we'll talk about an overlay product next. And then there's OpenFlow. OpenFlow requires new switches. So all of a sudden, the customer, because they want to do software network, software-defined networks, well, Cichlea isn't going to go buy new switches everywhere to make that happen. They're going to develop test beds to test the applications. They're going to see how the environment works, and it's going to have to work over the existing infrastructure today. And this is where that overlay technology allows us to start to work with a software-defined network environment without any change to the network guys. And this is really, it's going to be an interesting kind of political way to maneuver things too, because the networking guys have usually defined the environment. You get a certain rack, you get a certain access, you get certain bandwidth, you get certain security, and away you go. And the application people are looking at this environment going, geez, I can control all of this via an application programming interface. And you don't need the network guys anymore, except keep it running. You don't need to program that anymore. So when we look at the overlay, and this is, I was just in Kentucky a couple days ago talking to a university, and this was their big challenge because they were looking at what some of the other people were saying and doing in the environment, and how does he get there? Because he's planning his budgets 12 to 18 months out. So it's like, how do I get my fingers in this thing without spending a ton of money so I can prepare the environment because I want to get to a virtualized data center environment? And so when we look at SDNVE is our overlay product, and there's other products out there. VMware makes one, NSX, Cisco makes one called the V1000. There's a lot of technologies out there that do overlay. And I'm not here to sell you on this particular product. There's a number of different ways to do it. But the gist of it is that you've got a bunch of different components out there, a connectivity server, a management console. You've got some gateway technology plugging into the existing network. And essentially what this does is it allows you at the hypervisor level to create virtual networks that span the existing network infrastructure. It could be highly subnetted, it could be remote and subnetted inside of the enterprise as well. And this overlays the technology to allow virtual machines to work with each other in a layer two environment. And so it tunnels through the IP network. So again, it allows you to set up a virtualized environment across your existing infrastructure. You don't even have to communicate to the IP infrastructure people that you want to do this. It's going to go discover the network environment, set up its secret sauce, and away you go. What this allows us to do from an overlay advantage, it really allows you to cut network provisioning from days or months to minutes, because you don't care what the infrastructure looks like anymore. You don't care that it's highly subnetted. If you want to move a VM to a separate data center with this overlay product, you set up that communication, whether it's the red or the yellow virtual network, and you can move VMs from site to site without any issues at all. It really allows secure mobility across layer two and layer three environments. So it kind of breaks down the barriers of the hierarchical TCP/IP infrastructure. What does it do to the business or to the end user? It increases VM density. You can put more VMs in more spots without the network limiting where those VMs can go. It removes the networking bottleneck over there. So again, you're not going to, the tunneling protocol allows you not to have to deal with routing tables and the convergence and all of that that goes along with it. It looks like a big layer two span. And so we look down in a couple of examples that we did with large customers, enterprise workloads. The traditional network had 11,200 workloads. SDNV reduced that to a little over 1,000. And they were essentially making VMs that were separate, that had the same thing, because they were on different IP subnetworks. And by using the overlay technology, it's like, this becomes vMotion to the same VM. VDI, again, traditional network, 56,000 instances down to 1,100 again. So significant simplification, significant better utilization of your server environments. The other interesting thing is When you look at the cloud, and one of the topics that, when you think about cloud today, cloud is a term that, again, one of those interesting ones that means anything to anybody. But the interesting thing about the cloud is anybody can do it, and anybody can use it with services like Amazon delivers, you know, out there. You can participate in cloud. Hell, anybody can make a cloud, you know, if they want to. But how do you get the information from cloud to cloud and that? The underlying technology today is TCP/IP. And so it becomes difficult in a virtualized world. And again, I'm talking VM today. IBM's SDN technology is really hypervisor agnostic. Our first shipment is with VM. We're working with KVM, we're working with Xen, we're working with Hyper-V. We're really taking an agnostic view of that hypervisor. We think there's going to be more than one out there that customers use for different applications, for different environments. When we start to look at just the VLAN, you know, challenge in cloud technologies, we're limited by a hard number of 4,096. Well, many people don't think that's a big number. When you start looking at virtualization in the IP environment, it does create a lot of VLANs. With an overlay network, we can actually bring that up to 16,000. From a scaling standpoint. So we can support very, very, very large networks. And it also allows us to reuse IP addresses. And when you talk to many people that have, you know, real IP addresses, they're not NATing inside their network, everybody's constrained with IP addresses. And the minute you add a data center, you become more constrained. Everybody would like a class A address. Nobody gets those anymore. And those that have it don't want to subnet it up and share it. They want to keep their whole space. So many people are, IPv6 is one way, you know, getting there, and IPv6 has its own, you know, challenges to getting there and getting something that's completely up and running. But this overlay technology starts to simplify that. And it really simplifies data center consolidation, either from an expansion area or from a contraction area when you use an overlay, because again, it's using the same IP address scheme. From a server-to-server communication. It's still bound by IP rules with your service providers and carriers, but the overlay technology itself creates inside that data center an IP address that you're very familiar with and using at the home data center, if you will. So very easy to pop up second, third, and fourth data centers. Very easy to consolidate back in. So if you're retiring a data center and you're gonna bring it back in-house, you don't have to readdress everything. It's already the IP network that you've got. It's bring the servers in, rearrange the virtualized network, rearrange the virtualized hosts in a fashion that makes sense for the organization and climb back that resource. But you don't have to go through this big networking challenge to get there. OpenFlow is kind of the end game. And there are a few vendors out there that have OpenFlow switches, IBM being one of them. There's a number of other companies out there that have them as well, Brocade and Arista. Our two other vendors, but really OpenFlow really gives the ability for the network to evolve on the fly. It's kind of like changing the parts on an airplane in the air out there, although with less disastrous, you know, results. It's let the network get tuned to the application and to the environment that you want it to behave in. It's, do I need to use security? Do I need to use load balancing? Do I need to use content filtering? Do I need to use high-speed disk, low-speed disk, or flash? In this sense, what type, everything becomes a resource in that environment. And the application picks, via the programmers, picks what kind of resource do I want? A tier one, tier two, or tier three service. And that service should be determined by the return to the organization instead of how does it fit inside the structure and how do I give prioritization to it. And it's really via a well-defined forwarding instruction set. So when we look at the components of an OpenFlow network, there's a data plane, and that's the switch. And that switch can be anybody's. There isn't any interoperability, because essentially it's, I don't want to say it's a dumb switch, because it's got hardware silicon in there, and it's got an operating system, but it doesn't have any rules. When it goes in, it doesn't know where to forward. There's no routing protocol in there that can help make decisions. There's not even a bridge table that you could plug it in and have it be a layer two environment when it's in open flow mode. And then there's a control plane, and that control plane is a server. And that server has all the rule sets of that can be created and has base templates that allow you to build that flow on an application basis. So you've got the switch, and the switch has got, you know, ports plugged in. It has a flow table, which is very similar to a layer 2 MAC address table, and it's got a secure channel back to the OpenFlow controller. In the perfect world, the OpenFlow controller operates in a clustered environment. So you don't have what if I lose the OpenFlow controller and the whole network goes down the sewer? And you've got this controller environment that's got apps. And the apps can be controlled in a bunch of different ways. You set up the rule for the app and the controller, or there's an API via an orchestration tool that has a certain set of rules for OpenFlow. So if I'm running a SAP application or an Oracle application or voice over IP application, then I need a certain type of flow and a certain type of path, that those rule sets are in that OpenFlow controller. So when that application is seen, or for an unknown, if the switch basically sees an unknown flow, it goes back to the controller and says, do you know anything about this? I want to get to this IP source. I'm using this IP port number out there. What do I do with it? The OpenFlow controller will send back a rule set that says do A, B, C, D, and E, and away you go. And that's that very, very quick turnaround from a time. That's not a huge delay. An example of that is really at the bottom of this slide. So if source IP address equals a number and destination IP address equals this, then forward out a port 2. Really simple rule. If the VLAN is not 200 or not greater than 200, drop the packet. So it's not a big long list of 50 instructions, but there'll be a lot of sets of those instructions inside that OpenFlow controller to determine what you want to do. It's very, very fine-grained down there. When we look at some use cases, and this is typically the left is your typical enterprise network that has departmental VLANs, that have a switching infrastructure, that sometimes are firewall, sometimes not, depending on the security within an environment, has a set of core switches, generally has a set of core routers, comes out to another set of firewalls, out to the service provider, or maybe another set of internet. Sometimes that top set of routers is owned by the carrier, a Time Warner if you're getting a metro service, or yourself if you're plugging into something. And it's got another set of servers out there, so you've got a web presence or an internet presence that can be gotten and be accessed by external users as well as internal users. And it's a very siloed architecture, built by department. You've got a certain number. Every time the department gets stood up, in this example, you not only have to buy the switches, you've got to buy the firewalls. Out there, very expensive, and again, you use the firewalls for security, which is really, really, really important. But when I come back to the beginning of my talk and said you buy for what's the worst capacity case, everybody buys these really high performance firewalls and you tend to use them, you name the percentage of time. It's an underutilized resource within the network. What a software-defined environment allows you to do is start to pool those resources. You can actually bring them and cluster them in environments. An example would be firewalls. If I want to go to the outside of the network, I want to go to this IP address or anything but a localized address, I got to move that through the firewalls. And you load balance the firewalls so that it becomes an enterprise resource rather than a siloed appliance by department. Content filtering to the internet as well. I want to go out of the internet, I got to go through a content filter first. I want to go through a particular webified application, I want to go through a series of load balancers first. So instead of putting a load balancer in front of an application or in front of a server environment, it becomes a resource pod within the end user's environment. And when you think about that, it becomes a lot easier to scale. It becomes a lot easier to identify how am I using it. It becomes a lot easier to enforce a set of rules. When we come down and look at the firewall example on the left, who owns the firewall? What department is responsible for the rule set? When it's clustered on the right-hand side, the firewall department is the one that maintains that set. And it's a cluster that everybody participates in. And so it really starts to bring the network into an environment and a thinking thought process of, what are you going to do? What applications do you want to use? Where do the flows need to go, inside the company or outside the company? Another great example, if you think about some of the financial or insurance or healthcare departments, they've got some really strict rules for containing our information. And they're building these networks up with firewalls all over at a department level and worried about that application control, that with OpenFlow, again, you can cluster it and still move it. Now, we do have some standards boards that look at that, not necessarily standards board, compliance boards for security that like that multi-tiered. They think the physical separation is what gets you that security. So we're going to have a little time that we need to catch them up to the thought process of resources in the network rather than location-based appliances. But again, it allows us to think from an infrastructure. It's going to force us from an infrastructure standpoint to think a little differently. And the application people are really going to grab resources within the network via the tool sets that are available to them. Again, I talked a little bit about the data center consolidation, multiple data centers. I can use the same IP subnet, use the same addressing scheme in an overlay network. And in reality, at the separation between the two data centers with the service provider's router, that's obviously a separate subnetted, it's a separate network. But to the data resources, it's the same network. So again, virtualization, the movement of those resources become very, very easy to do. From a product set, it's a lot of software and a couple pieces of hardware. So our first product is a VM ready product. It was a very, very early, how do we work with virtualization technology? IBM then bought a company, a networking company that has a series of OpenFlow based switches. And those OpenFlow based switches support today's layer 2 and 3 protocols, as well as OpenFlow. So in many of the discussions I have with prospective clients, you can plug into your existing network today and do everything you want to do, and you can turn OpenFlow on when you want to. And it's an interesting topic of discussion because generally server technology is acquired much more frequently than networking technology today. Generally speaking, server technology gets purchased in 3-year chunks. Networking technology is now 5, 6, 7, 8. So when customers are looking at networking technology, we're suggesting look for that flexibility. Because if you get to a software-defined environment and you can't play in OpenFlow, you're going to create an overlay, which is okay. But you're not going to get to the end game until the next network change, which again could be 5 to 8 years down the road. IBM sells an OpenFlow controller. There's a lot of other companies that sell OpenFlow controllers. We just released our SDNVE, and that's the overlay technology. In August, we announced some more capabilities in OpenFlow from a feature set on the switches, and then Open Daylight's really the direction that we're going. Has anybody heard of Open Daylight? Okay, got a couple. So that's really an open source effort. So there's really 4 big efforts that IBM is participating in the open source environment. I'm gonna hit the far right first, because the Open Daylight is probably the initial first thing that many people will see. And that's basically an open source OpenFlow controller. IBM provided a lot of technology from our SDNVE product. Cisco's provided some technology from their hardware server standpoint. And we really look to see, although I'd love to sell an OpenFlow controller, I think the end game in that market is there'll be companies like, and I know you're all Linux people, so I don't want to bastardize or select any name out there, but there's companies that were created to distribute Linux. And they're public companies today. We see the same thing happening here, that they take the open source distribution of Open Daylight and all the features there, and there will be companies that distribute and sell OpenFlow controllers under whatever name a user's creative enough to create. So would we see the Red Hat of an OpenFlow controller? Might. Could we see a Debian version of it? Might. Nothing's stopping because it's all open source. IBM does not envision itself being the big flag bearer of the OpenFlow controller. It makes a lot more sense to have something that's more open that people plug into. Different applications, different widgets, different things to do to program switches and to extract information in switches than wait for a company like IBM to do that. But taking it off from a key foundation level, we felt was pretty important. OpenStack is kind of the interface to Open Daylight, to an OpenFlow controller. So this becomes more of an application window primarily focused today at cloud services as to defining parameters on a cloud app and to control the network underneath it. And again, we think that's pretty significant. We've got quite a few resources, you know, working on that effort within the company. There's also a standards council out there that everybody says they're gonna behave and participate in. And then there's the Open Virtualization Alliance, which is all the other guys. So VMware is the big fish in that virtualization environment today. But all, you know, alternate virtualizations we think are important. And there's other companies out there that want to play in that and will come up with a solution that has a certain benefit to the market and a certain use to the market. And we think that that's pretty important. So IBM as a whole has got more than over 600 people in this open source effort, kind of trying to drive solutions to a software networking architecture out there for the open source community. Open Daylight, this is just kind of a depiction of this, but the Open Daylight product sits up in the software layer, again, interfaced to the controller platform, which will control network services. And then OpenFlow is one of the protocols that will talk to the switch. So this Open Daylight, again, is that consortium of people developing solutions. And the far right is the list of companies. Certain levels of sponsors, platinum, gold, and silver. IBM is a platinum sponsor with this Open Daylight project and has donated technology to kickstart that group. That's it for my slides. Do we have any questions?
Fewer firewalls, you kind of reduce the amount of stuff, and you have overhead from OpenFlow. Mm-hmm. How does that handle bandwidth-wise?
So I don't know that we may reduce the firewall question. We may reduce the number of firewalls. They may become bigger firewalls. So instead of a bunch of mid-size or small-range systems, clients will maybe still be able to build that with a load balanced environment. If they want to use smaller devices, they could do that and load balance it. There's a lot of great technologies out there to do that. Or they could silo into a couple of big firewalls, depending on their perspective of that. OpenFlow is a protocol that has an overhead. It's flow based, so it doesn't go everywhere. It's kind of on an as needed by what switch as it sees it. And it will have timers that age out. So we don't see a bandwidth hit as much as what's the latency in a really big network, especially in if you're combining it with an overlay, because you've still got that latency in the routed environment that you can't get out of until you get away with it. So it's interesting. It's going to be a journey to get to an open flow network. It's not going to be an event, you know, that you do. I mean, maybe the end, when you turn it off, it becomes an event, but it's gonna be a transition that you bolt on an OpenFlow cluster, pod, whatever, and start to work with that and still communicate with all the overlay and kind of move that over time into an OpenFlow. But we don't see significant performance or bandwidth. We've almost at a point, as you say, bandwidth's infinite, but when you start to look at where 10 gig pricing is today, and you start to look at the 40 gig curve coming down, there's been some disruptive pricing in 100 gig. It does create some problems, fiber, with the plant itself, as to what fiber you have in there and what you can support. But bandwidth's almost not the issue anymore. It's latency and jitter in your network, especially when you become video enabled and video communication. And OpenFlow should help that.
My environment right now is Cisco Border, so Cisco Core, with Dell switches and Juniper IDPs and firewalls.
Mm-hmm.
So can I overlay
Absolutely. Your
VDE and control all of that
Yep. With
your one product?
Yep. The interesting thing about the product, and I promised that myself I wouldn't talk about pricing, but SDN VE is licensed on a socket basis. And it's $159 a socket. I'm not retiring quota. My team is retiring quota on SDNVE. But it's somewhat gated by some of the other products out there are very inexpensive. They're trying to get that market seeded and work with it. And that $159 also includes a year of support on there as well. So It's not a quota buster for me, but it's a technology that can work with all that stuff. And I've actually, over the last 2 weeks, a number of clients have said, I'm going to try it. First and foremost, because NSX is not due till next year, and there's a little concern with the tie, hype company-wise, hypervisor NSX. Are you really gonna work with everybody else, and does it become kind of the Microsoft conundrum that, you know, we know our APIs, you don't know all of them out there. So it becomes kind of an agnostic view of, I want an overlay that's separate from the hypervisor, that may or may not be separate from the networking equipment. Most likely it will be, just because of market share. And then how do I get to the end game?
We have, at my business, we have like an Indian firewall and probably six managed switches set up. Mm-hmm. Would this software pretty much remove the need for those managed switches and allow me to replace them with dummy switches and have one central location to control all the network?
So when you say, what kind of switches do you have?
They're Cisco.
Are you routing or are you at layer two? The overlay product could work right with them. You wouldn't make any changes. And then at your next acquisition, you could get an open flow switch, which bet you bought anything that it's going to be less expensive than the Cisco switches you bought.
We're looking to upgrade pretty soon anyway. Yep.
An open flow switch should be less expensive than that. And the key component you got to look at, though, in all respect, is what's the open flow controller going to cost you? And again, there's some open source stuff out there you can go get. You can actually download OpenDaylight. You know, anybody can go get that and start to work with it if they want, or do you want somebody's prepackaged version? It's interesting, as the hardware vendors are reducing their cost, it somehow is getting sucked up in a piece of software that isn't ours out there. So there's a little bit of a transition there, but I think ultimately the price will come down on that open flow controller, or that open source effort, people to spin it and get their base set. And the community will support different applications that people will use. Yep?
Do you see open flow leading to scale up or scale out regarding switching? Thinking in terms of fewer bigger switches, or moving the switching out into the periphery?
Well, it's interesting. It's a good question. And you kind of come back and you look at the data paths. And I was with a client about a month ago, and together in the room, we were kind of thinking, okay, what does OpenFlow buy me in kind of this hierarchical network for end users? And there's really a defined path, you know, that you can't get around. I mean, you generally don't build that network horizontally. You build it vertically to come back to a core switch. The one environment that it does make a play is voice over IP for desk set to talk to each other. But you're still going to have to go through the core router, you know, type of thing. So the open flow switch price will drive down the wiring closet price some more, but I don't know that open flow can help a lot. Although I just thought, you know, another one, you go out to the internet, I want to go to the content filter first, you know, type of thing. But you could also trap that communication at the router. So it comes down just your complete natural environment, it hits the core switch, and then out the internet, you look at the port on the router, needs to go out, it's going to go into the open flow network to the whatever appliances you want it to go. We still think that we don't make a big router. There are no plans for us to make a big router. We think there's a place for a big router where speed isn't that important. It's fast enough type of thing, and the lines of code for control are beneficial today, and it does leave, I don't want to say it throws a bone to the network guys, but it's still kind of the heart of the network, and there's a level of importance there. There is a company that did create a chassis-based OpenFlow router. They've gotten not very far with it because of the trust in that big router, and that's going to take some time if there isn't even a business benefit to doing it. We see the OpenFlow, the layer two-ness of what it brings, as a huge advantage to the data center. We were saying that through some of our studies that 70% of the traffic in a data center stays in the data center. It doesn't go out the internet, it doesn't go up to the user community, it stays inside the data center. And when you look at that hierarchical routed design, there's a lot of delay that's in that. There's a lot of impact to an application. I just got blown out of the water 2 weeks ago when I heard some of our friends at Facebook, and Google would probably be a similar thing. The guy at Facebook said 1,000 times more traffic stays in the data center than goes out. 1,000 times. That's blows by 70% number way out. At the same point in time, not everybody's a Facebook. And not everybody's a Google from their data requirements. So 70% is still a huge number that again, we're going up and down in the network through that core box, through that 5,500 box to go server to server. And when you get into an open flow environment, that east-west thing never hits the router. So much of the sales pitch and technology pitch that I deliver is that router lasts longer. You don't need as many 10 gig interfaces. You don't need 100 gig in there. You don't need 40 gig in there because your end users are, a lot of companies say 100 meg. You know, they're not giving a lot of desktop users gig connections. So that router can live a long time in there at those speeds, but my data center velocity needs to be a lot higher.
How about IPv6 support and open flow? Is your product doing
V6
support?
Yep, so V6 underlying protocol doesn't matter. V4 or V6 to SDN VE.
So you're running V3, the open flow, or V4 open flow?
On our controller, we're not 1.3. It doesn't, on the overlay product, it's not an open flow solution. So we're gonna overlay on your IP network, it could be V4 or V6. We're not one, our controller is scheduled, I think, first quarter next year to be 1.3. Okay. Today it's 1.0. So I think most of the interest has been from a test and get your fingers wet has been an overlay. Because they're not buying any switches, they're not worried about the investment in the controller. They kind of want to wait and see who's going to win the controller war and how cost effective can it be. Any other questions? Thank you. Take time, enjoy your weekend, enjoy your time.